vested interest in this panel because I started trying to weasel my way into Sustainable Harvest International just a little bit over a year ago, and I found out there's a lot of great people working with and for this organization. So everyone on this panel has some kind of a connection to this organization, Sustainable Harvest International. They are based here in New England, but they carry out their work in Central America. We've got Sophie Haynes from the UK. She's from University of College London. We've got Phil Bailey, who's the Development Coordinator for Sustainable Harvest. We've got Nana Mensa, who is the Belize Country Director for Sustainable Harvest. And Ashley Mason, who did a pretty phenomenal internship for SHI 2 summers ago then, right? Mm-hmm. And she created a monitoring and evaluation process for the organization, which I was very impressed with, and I'm so very glad to have Ashley on the panel today. We will begin the presentation with Sophie Haynes. Sophie recently completed her master's in anthropology and ecology of development at the University of College London, very recently, and she should be very proud of this. And she also just started her doctoral work at University of College London. She's currently working on a project examining the Southern Highway and its Sophie will tell you a little bit more about this, but the Southern Highway in Belize. And she won the Royal Anthropological Institute Pokhart Prize in 2004 for an essay concerning political landscapes in Israel and Palestine. And then my personal relationship with Sophie is that we did some pretty interesting research together in Belize this last summer. So I'm very excited to hear the full presentation of her research.
Thanks, Christine. Okay, so basically the presentation I'm going to give today is quite a general overview, just on mainly about the socio-political aspects of sustainable agriculture and development outreach projects in southern Belize. As Christine mentioned, my master's research, which I did this summer, was a bit more specific concerning the impact of the paving of the Southern Highway on agricultural livelihoods, which, again, a lot of the issues that are pertinent there are going to come up in this overview as well. So I'm going to look at the location of the study and give a brief context, mention some of the key issues which are affecting agricultural choices due to their impact on land use and land tenure, so rights and distribution of land, and also the socio-political context, different groups having different opinions and different interests over the land issues. And then I'm going to look in a bit more detail about the agricultural implications of this. So how the agricultural methods that are used in the area, both those that are established and those which are being introduced, have impacts on social and political organisation, and how this relates to crop choice as well, and the interaction and balance between cash and subsistence cropping. A brief mention of several of the risks and insecurities in this case, which might help to clarify maybe why some past development projects might not have been as effective as hoped, and also some hopes for future possibilities for sustainable and risk mitigation measures in agriculture. So in terms of location, Belize is situated in Central America on the Caribbean coast. It's a fairly small country, and where we were working and where SHI is based is down in the southern Toledo district. Belize was a British colony until 1981, so it's fairly recently independent. There's great ethnic diversity, so there's several different ethnic groups, and with different cultural histories, different ways of using the land. There's great ecological diversity. The area where I was working is mostly inland in a tropical deciduous forest, and if you go further across to the west, you reach the Mayan Mountains and the border with Guatemala. And there's several land uses making use of these different ecological niches. So a lot of small scale subsistence and cash farming, but also some larger scale plantations growing citrus, bananas, cattle ranches, growing and tourism initiatives, and a couple of protected areas as well. So the land tenure issue is extremely pertinent in this case, and it formed a big part of my literature review and also my research on the ground this summer. And it's very complex, even by the admission of the Belizean state in a report they published in 2000. So a large majority of the land in Toledo is still officially national land. although there is some property, some reserve, forest areas, sort of protected areas, and also a small proportion of Maya Reservation, which is land which is given over usufruct rights to the Indian population. Although this is quite an outdated system, the areas covered don't necessarily match up with the population settlement areas, and also the usufruct rights are liable to be repossessed at any time by the government, so it's not necessarily a very secure tenural system. A lot of farmers and some smallholders are trying to take on leases these days, and this is being encouraged by the state, by several NGOs working in the area, and these are available subject to survey and certain fees. It is good in terms of the individualised security it will give. It will give more long-term security to an individual farmer to have their land demarcated, but it is an extremely bureaucratic process, and the surveying itself does cost money. So that has implications for, especially in more remote rural areas where farmers might not necessarily have access to the support and advice needed to get the application through. There are also conditions for the gaining of leases. So for example, I think it's 50% of the land must be planted with permanent crops. So as I'll look at a bit more later on, that does have an effect on the agricultural landscape, particular crop rotations. The implications of that. So as this shows, really political economy and ecology of land tenure is really quite complex, and there's several different interest groups and fractures within those interest groups. Shall I look at a bit more now? As I said, it's a recently independent state, therefore there's still continuing relevance of pre-colonial and colonial history with different interest groups, different political groups, different ethnic groups vying for rights over land related to history and also resources. The citizenship debates and social movements are quite vital at the moment, whether at village level in terms of village councils expressing their own demarcated rights to particular village areas and kind of closed community. Also at a district level, groups such as the TMCC, which is the Toledo Maya Cultural Council, which is actually now defunct, but has been succeeded by a newer organisation called the Hunyan Cho Society, who are campaigning for Indigenous Maya rights to a homeland, so really an updating of the reservation system with more rights. And also agricultural cooperatives who are working for further rights and social justice for the farmers. And some of these groups are actually bringing lawsuits against the government at the moment in terms of conflicts over protected areas specifically, so it'll be interesting to see how these pan out over the next few months, definitely, and how they relate to development initiatives such as oil exploration, protected areas, ecotourism. In terms of agricultural choices and implications relating to actual agricultural methods, the established Mayan systems of Milpa and Matambre are interesting here. Milpa is a slash and burn system, rotational system for growing usually corn and beans. And Matambre is more of a slash and mulch system. It can also be used for similar crops, but it depends very much on the ecology of the area and the actual season, so it's a bit more limited in scope. And I think what's important to realise here is these particular established methods do have very close links in with, you know, social cycles, seasonal cycles, domestic organisation, communal labour organisation within villages. Although they are actually, especially the slash and burn system is on the decline now, partly due to the efforts of NGOs in the area trying to stem the environmental degradation which could result from that. And also concerns about fires getting out of control, which was definitely an issue for a lot of the farmers that we spoke with.
The fires
burning other people's land, basically, and not being contained. So this ties into a more general discourse on environmental degradation and agricultural methods, especially relating to slash and burn agriculture, which is quite contentious because some studies have shown that slash and burn can be perfectly sustainable in certain situations if it's managed properly with proper fallow periods allowed. But this is becoming increasingly difficult due to the insecurity of land tenure. So if the land, fallow land is liable to be repossessed, then it's likely that people will shorten their fallow land in order to keep the land looking as if it's productive and in use at that particular time. So in that way, the economic and political pressures are also having an effect on the environment. So it's important here to remember the role of what can be called, I suppose, traditional ecological knowledge. So specific knowledge that the farmers in the area have of their particular environment, what works, what's been working over time, and also the methods that do already exist and can be built on and with more outreach and extension through certain organisations for methods for nitrogen fixing, for example, through leguminous plants, macuna, beans, kudzu, which can be planted in with the other crops. Also expansion of Matambre where that is ecologically possible, and to remember the socio-cultural considerations, so the effects that might result from a decline in certain agricultural methods. And in terms of the crop choices which are available, this relates very closely to the methods. So if shifting milpa agriculture is discouraged and privatisation is encouraged, then that results in an increase in permanent cropping, as opposed to the shifting agriculture of maize and beans and sometimes rice as well. So I mentioned the ecological implications there, and that also ties in with land pressure and production pressure. So through asserting land rights by planting permanent crops, you're also adding into a tension between individual and communal security. So you can have your individual land secured through a lease with permanent crops, but that is at odds with some of the Mayan and the indigenous movements which are trying to assert communal security through maintaining their land pools. And if you plant cacao orchards, for example, then you are taking land away from that, which is important to remember, even if that is a promising way to go down, especially with fair trade and cacao, which is burgeoning definitely in that area. So you do get economic stability, but it's important to remember the impacts that will have on existing livelihoods. That also brings up the tension between cash and subsistence cropping. So a lot of people that were previously relying on subsistence and trade in kind are now finding more of a need for cash to pay things, such as utility bills, as the infrastructure stretches out into the more remote areas. So there is a lot of livelihood diversification going on, and I think it would be important to be able to support that, the securities both for wage labour and for supplementary farming, or else for farming with supplementary labour, which is a delicate balance, I think. So in conclusion, I think important suggestions for sustainability for the future would definitely involve continued consideration of local knowledge specific to the environment, as well as the expertise of outside agronomists and scientists who can maybe synthesise methods that will be suitable to the area. Also, encouraging fair trade and organic certification to provide economic stability, although with special care taken to avoid any situations which could make the farmers more vulnerable either to natural disasters or to market fluctuations. As I mentioned, support for livelihood diversification, and also, I think, very importantly, local participation in decision making of all sorts, so not just agricultural but across the board in terms of development initiatives and changes in the area. And as Ashley's going to talk much more about, there's definitely a need for ongoing monitoring of any projects and good reflexivity for the organisations and agents that are involved. So thank everyone who's helped me be here today.
My impression is that shifting slash and burn or slash and mulch cultivation is generally a response to having quite a bit of land and a fairly small population, and that as the population increases, you get pressure to cultivate more land more intensively and not to shift as often, which breaks down the fallow. It seems like as that transfer begins to happen, there are sort of a couple of choices as to where farming systems can head, whether they head into monocropping and industrial systems or into a more sort of smallholder system with intensive, constant cropping on the same land, but that includes similar sort of mulching systems or animal systems to maintain fertility. I guess my question is how you can look at ways to encourage those sorts of transitions or to negotiate a transition so that it just doesn't go right from one into another.
Sure. I think obviously it depends on an awful lot of factors, and in Belize is slightly different from the rest of Central America in that the population hasn't reached that kind of level of density in the surrounding areas. So a lot of the pressures are more to do with production pressure and political economic pressure rather than straightforward population mm-hmm. pressure. Again, it is being encouraged by things such as the fair trade agreements for things like cacao and I think for spices possibly in the future, which will encourage more permanent cropping, more kind of fixed plot farming, and also livelihood diversification and a lot of people actually abandoning agriculture for other jobs. And maybe maintaining a small garden, but actually not depending so much on agriculture as a main way of life. So it's not really a direct answer, because I think it could go in a lot of directions.
Yeah.
So. Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the Mayan Cultural Council. Give us a little bit more background on some of the issues and just its history.
Okay. The TMCC was set up, I believe, in the late 80s as a council of Mayan indigenous people from Toledo District who were trying to campaign for, as I said, an extension of the reservation system, which would be a lot more secure and a lot more independent of state and economic fluctuations. And in order to do that, in 97, leading up to 97, they teamed up with the geography department at UC Berkeley and produced a book of maps, which was to map out the land use in every single one of the Maya villages and prove that it was being used productively, to explain the culture, to give a lot more background, and to try and disseminate that information and kind of justify their claims. And they did have a certain amount of effect in that the government did sign some agreements saying that they were going to acknowledge and recognise the Maya's input into future development initiatives. And that was on paper, but there is a lot of debate as to how far that's actually got in practice. And in 1998, their leader died under mysterious circumstances. And so the movement kind of devolved from that because he was an extremely charismatic leader, and it took a few years for the movement to revitalize. There's a lot of internal fragmentation between the different Maya groups and also between the Maya and the other ethnic groups in Belize. As I said, there's quite a few different cultural groups who maybe felt that they were being overlooked in terms of international attention, at least. So, as I mentioned, I think briefly, the Huyancho Society is, I think that's quite a young organisation. It's been working for about a year now to kind of pick up from where that association left off and to maybe build up more partnerships with other cultural groups in the area and to kind of consolidate the movement a bit more to work for maybe not as ambitious an end result, so maybe not an entire homeland, but to increase awareness in the more remote villages so people know their rights and know how to respond when the development initiatives are imposed in their areas.
We have time for one more question.